It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Before we get into all the stuff that I want to talk about, good news today out of the White House. And thank goodness for Joe Biden and Marty Walsh at the Department of Labor. Today they announced, finally, the development of a federal rule requiring employers to keep their workers safe from heat exposure. Extreme heat is a killer. We know it's something I've been calling for years. Some kind of a rule to say, hey, when temperatures are jumping up here, maybe you need to have a little extra break. Maybe you need a little extra hydration. Maybe you need to do something to, well, mitigate some of that. Fans, I don't know. But good. Now, the Labor Department's Occupational Safety and Health Administration, they're going to apply this new rule that they're coming up with to both indoor and outdoor workspaces. Always, you know, the devil in the details kind of stuff. Going to take a bit of time. The White House said that it's taking the initial steps right now to make the process down the road. Could do sometime in October, perhaps, hoping for that. The president said in a statement, he was doing it because of the record temperatures that we saw over the summer in places like the Pacific Northwest, where we literally had hundreds of people die from heat exposure. And it's one of these things that doesn't really get reported. And finally, somebody who seems to give a you know what. Now, he said, quote, rising temperatures pose an imminent threat to millions of American workers exposed to the elements, to kids in schools without air conditioning, to seniors in nursing homes without cooling resources, and particularly the disadvantaged communities. Because we haven't done anything on the climate change front. Haven't. And we're probably not going to, because evidently Joe Manchin's going to be writing the climate rules going forward. So capitalism is going to decide, going to figure this out. And working people are going to eventually at some point start having to sue for being injured in the workplace. Workers' compensation claims are going to go up, all this stuff. If we're unable and unwilling to govern ourselves and protect our workforce, well, capitalism will have to do that. Another good thing this weekend, the workers at Nabisco in plants all across this country, from Oregon to Chicago to Virginia, all of the workers there ratified their contract with Mondelez, which means Oreos made in the U.S. are now okay. Go get them to crush up in your cakes and dip in your milk. What is being described as a major victory for the workers. The company had wanted like a two-tier healthcare system. That didn't happen. They wanted to destroy the premium pay overtime on weekends thing. That didn't happen. The concession, from what I understand, they did have to give a Friday, Saturday, Sunday start time, 12-hour days for workers to be able to work those, which will cut down on overtime. But overall, incredible victory. A $5,000 ratification bonus, which I'm generally not thrilled with, but they got that. Increased the company's match to their 401k plan, and they're going to get raises in each contract year, which, yep, it's what they wanted. So this is one of those things where the company said, hey, we're going to get our workers back together. We're going to provide the snacks. They now have a contract. So Danny DeVito's call of no contract, no snacks. We now have contracts so we can all have snacks. And on that front, AOC said over the weekend as well that, you know, children should have the right, toddlers should have the right to snacks and naps. I'm with her on that as well. So good stuff. Good way to start today off. Pretty happy. Now, the other side. Insurrection 2.0. Remember, we were told there's going to be this giant, you know, what were they calling this? You know, justice for J6 or whatever craziness that is. I was told to expect at least, at minimum, 10,000 MAGA hat wearing maniacs storming our nation's capital. about 200 people showed up. We're talking, you know, the Insurrection sequel, major flop. Like most sequels, major flop. Overall, I was told about 500 people showed up. You had about 50-50. You had the MAGA folk, and then you had the anti-MAGA folk. And it was interesting watching some of the videos of people screaming at each other. You know, the part that I liked mostly is there seemed to be like six cops for every one person there. And I did. I spent some time watching grown men yell and scream at each other in these ridiculous videos. Grown men acting like children because they think somehow if they spew their rhetoric louder, if they use more expletive-laden sentences, that somehow that's going to, or if they wave their flag in your face enough, somehow that's going to convince you, and they're going to win the argument, which is ridiculous. That's not, it's fun to watch for a couple of minutes, but when you really sit down and you think about it, you know, what are you accomplishing? Nothing. I'm not sure what the prize out of this thing was, because they didn't get to storm the Capitol again. They didn't get to, you know, erect a gallows. They didn't get to want to hang the vice president, although I know all 250 of those probably would want to. But I'm watching this stuff going, you know, play stupid games, win stupid prizes, because, like I said, they were outnumbered by law enforcement like 6-1. And as I thought about it, if I'm one of the law enforcement people, do I put up with the kind of stuff that they put up with back on January 6th? Oh, no. And in fact, you know, being only human, you had to think that the law enforcement was just begging for them to get out of hand so that they could use the iron fist and, you know, do what Trump would want them to, go all Trumpian on them. But that didn't happen. It went off. It was nothing, really. And what was interesting to me, and I'm sure, I hope everyone else paid attention too, was the fact that while we were told there are going to be all these people showing up to the justice for the treason crowd from back in January. I mean, stop and think about that for a second. You actually got 250 people to show up to say that the criminals who broke into our Capitol need something, some justice. And I agree, justice needs to be served, but not getting them out of jail. In my view, you try them, you convict them, and you put them in jail for a long period of time as an example of why you don't do that. But we have a history in this country of the traitors and the treasonous folks, of letting them off easy. Think Civil War. Just kind of throwing that out there. But it is amazing to me how well-coordinated the right-wing message machine is. Because over here, where they wanted us to look originally was to this, you know, Insurrection 2.0, it flopped, but they had Plan B all ready for us. They had it, they really had it queued up. And look, this is what they do. They're great at it. The right-wing spin machine, fabulous. The right-wing politicians understand messaging. They understand timing better than anything. And look, you put some cops on horseback wearing cowboy hats. I think one of them had a bullwhip. Going chasing down Haitian people through the water and you know, rounding them up like cattle. Man, what could get the right wing more tizzy and in a tizzy and all lathered up in the panties than that? Than literally whipping people in the water so that you could round them up. Yeah. And that's what made the right wing all happy on Saturday. The insurrection flop was forgiven, because the FBI, which was a honeypot, you know, they wanted to get people there so they could arrest them. If you're a criminal, you deserve to be arrested. Yeah, I agree. But they made a nice transition, didn't they? So that they could go away from how bad they flopped over here and really push over there. Now, the White House, you know, said that, you know, look, the images of what the Border Patrol with what appeared to be a whip were obviously horrific, according to them. Me, I'm saying you start firing some of these people, and you lock them up. This is not how you do your job. But the right wing, some of the emails I got from folks, all happy and thrilled, and oh, just could not be more exuberant over the fact that this was going on. Also, the other. Over the weekend, I got a bunch of people yelling at me that the left hates doctors. This popped up as well. And evidently, a doctor from Oregon basically surrendered his medical license, is how this report reads once you get through the headline. Because the headline was the Oregon, you know, the state of Oregon ripped his, you know, his medical license from him because he refused to wear a mask. And they basically asked him, look, are you going to wear a mask while treating patients? Are you going to require your staff and people who you're bringing into your medical office to wear masks? Are you going to stop preaching this nonsense that masks don't work and they can poison you? And he said no. He was asked if he would, given the choice between wearing the mask and doing what the community wants or spewing lies and nonsense, he said that he would, without question, give up his medical license and stop practicing medicine. And they obliged. That's how I read it. Now the story read was that the Oregon Medical Board revoked his license because he refused to wear a mask, and that got the crazy people, wow, losing their minds. When the reality is this guy has been really been preaching nonsense for a while. This idea that if you wear a mask, it could cause your lungs to collapse, it could give you pneumonia, it could cause strokes. It could lead to carbon dioxide poisoning, which evidently has been debunked, time and time again. But again, you get one guy in the medical profession to come out and say, yeah, everything they're telling you over there is false. Come to me, buy my snake oil, do whatever. So they revoked his license. Now, Ohio, conversely, went the other direction. You remember Dr. Tenpenny, the woman, the magnet woman, the woman who said, if you got the vaccine, you're now a magnet. Yeah, I tried. I really did. I was hoping because it would come in handy. If I was magnetized, it might come in handy. You never know. I didn't work on me, but I digress. Ohio gave her license, renewed her license. This is the woman who basically is making a killing off of telling people if you get the vaccine, you'll grow a third nipple or something. Crazy. And the thing is you get these crackpots on things like TikTok. And I spent a little time, watching TikTok over the weekend. And wow, people literally losing their minds over the rest of us being tired with their ridiculous nonsense. Over the idea that we want people to respect us. Now, I met a guy this last week that, and again, it was refreshing to finally meet someone who goes, look, I'm not going to get the vaccine. And here's why. I have some medical issues. I'm not 100% sure that it's, I'm a guy who gets, whenever I take drugs or whenever I take something, I always get the most extreme reactions. So he says, look, I'm not in great health. I'm not comfortable with it. He goes, but I am responsible. I believe in being responsible. I wear a mask. I socially distance. I don't go into large crowds. I'm doing everything I can do to keep myself safe first. Personal responsibility first. And then keeping everybody else safe. And he goes, look, I understand. I know that I'm putting my family at risk. I know I'm putting my wife, my kids, my neighbors, my friends. I know I'm doing that. And I tell them, look, here's the situation. And when they're around, I wear the masks. They do too. We're as safe as we can be given the situation. And I go, you know what? I respect that. I actually respect that because, look, he cares about somebody else. He knows that what he's doing is could put someone else at risk, and he's taking measures to stop. My problem with the anti-vax nitwits is they think that, well, I should be able to literally spit on your neck and breathe on you anytime I want because it's my freedom. And that's where this whole idea of my rights over your rights clash. We're trying to do the right thing. We're trying to get through this. We're trying to find a way to get to the other side. Look, nobody knows all the answers. And things are going to change. And you have to be a little bit flexible. But in the end of this, I look at this guy and I go, if we had more people like this who are going, look, I want to be responsible. If I had, you know, fewer health conditions, if I didn't get extreme reactions to things like, you know, like vaccines or you know, medications that they give, you know, I would do it. But given my situation, respect my ability to keep myself safe because I'm respecting yours. And that to me, how can you argue with that? You can't. And at least I can't. The people who I normally come across are like, yeah, heck with you, blankety blank, blankety blank, blank. I'm never blankety this or that, or blankety that. No one's trying to take your freedoms away. We're trying to protect ours. And I get this nonsense from these folks all the time. You're taking my freedom. Slowly, you're taking my freedoms. First, you started with the seat belts, and then with the DUI checkpoints, and what's it going to be next? And look, they take a little kernel of something. You go, yeah. Do they overreach in some areas? Yeah. But when you're talking about public safety, when you're talking about others, it's important to be cognizant of the other. I find it interesting that the people who tell me that they're stealing my freedoms, they're the very people who don't believe in the idea of the commons, that there is anything that is outside of their power. What we have to do through all this is we've got to figure out how to protect ourselves against getting infected. And then we've got to figure out how, when someone is infected, we treat that. And then we've got to figure out how to deal with severe diseases. Right now, what we know is that if you get the vaccine, even if you get COVID, you're going to have a better outcome. People in the hospitals right now that are dying at the much higher rate are the unvaccinated. And I'll be honest, I struggle having sympathy with them because we're put in this situation again and again and again because people won't be respectful. People won't do the right things. And then they go, oh, gee, I got sick. Who knew? Well, everyone. Hello, welcome to the conversation. There is no one who hates wearing a mask more than this guy. There is nobody who hates getting a shot more than this guy. There is nobody who hates being told what to do more than this guy. But when my doctor says, Rick, this is how we get through this, I got to listen to him and I got to believe him. And when the medical experts that I talk to say, this is the path, for me, that's the path. I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. There's nothing more American.
Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1875. That was the day anti-black violence erupted into a two-day massacre in Clinton, Mississippi. As many as 2,500 black Republicans and their families met at Moss Hill, a former plantation destroyed during the Civil War. The day was one of festivities and political speeches ahead of the fall elections. The county Republican Party invited local Democrats to debate. The Democratic state senatorial candidate did address the crowd. The editor of a local Republican newspaper and union officer, Captain H.T. Fisher, followed him. Soon, a group of white Democrats began to heckle Fisher as he spoke. Republican politicians attempted to quell the growing tensions. Almost immediately, however, the heckling whites opened fire on the crowd. Women and children fled in all directions as black Republican forces rushed to defend themselves and their families. By the end of the day, 3 whites and 5 blacks were killed. Clinton's mayor fed off rumors of black retaliation. He called upon white paramilitary forces, the White Liners, from surrounding areas for assistance. Several hundred answered the call and filled the town's streets. Historian Melissa Janczewski-Jones notes that though heavily armed, the White Liners accompanied white locals as they rampaged door to door looking for black Republicans to murder. After 2 days, as many as 50 black Clintonians were killed by white Democrats looking to end Reconstruction and regain political control of Mississippi. A Senate committee would later conclude, quote, the riots at Clinton were part of a special purpose on the part of the Democrats to break up the meetings of Republicans and inaugurate an era of terror not only in those communities, but throughout the state.
Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com. Here at the Rick Smith Show, we don't accept corporate advertising. Never have, never will. In fact, we spend most of our time giving corporations the finger. We don't stop the show every few minutes to sell you supplements, beet juice, or whatever snake oil the right-wing loonies are pawning. That's because we're not sellouts. It's also because we're supported by our friends in labor and by people like you. If you like what we do, become a patron by going to patreon.com/Rick Smith Show. That's patreon.com/Rick Smith Show. Give what you can, if you can, and help us fight for the working class majority. Because together we bargain, divided we beg. Thank you for tuning in.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, I gotta tell you, it's hard to believe it's been 10 years since the Occupy movement. I mean, it's been 10 years since all the things that we went through, 10 years since we started talking about the 99% against the 1%. As I was saying back at the time, about time we begin the class war, about time we wake up to the reality that as working people, we've been getting the short end of the stick for a very long time. About time we wake up to all of the divisions that the wealth class has used to pit us against each other so they can rob us blind and do what they've done effectively. They've created the largest billionaire class in the history of civilization, and they've done it off of our backs. Nothing new. You go back to Jay Gould in the 1880s, who said, "I could easily pay off the working class to murder the other half." We're reliving bad history. And here to share some thoughts of the 10th anniversary of the Occupy movement. Maybe share some thoughts on, you know, what's come out of that, the good, the bad, the not so good. I've asked Sharon Seltzer, Sarah Seltzer, to come talk with me. Sarah is the executive editor of Lilith Magazine. She's got a new piece out, Sexism and Racism on the Left. What has and hasn't changed since Occupy Wall Street? She's got this piece over at The Nation. Sarah, thanks for taking some time for us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So
I also can't believe it's been 10 years.
Exactly, right? I mean, I'm looking at this, I'm going, 10 years seems like just yesterday. And, you know, stuff that we've been talking about in this program for years, they were bringing to light. A lot of good things, I think, came out of it. The Fight for 15 movement, the student debt, you know, discussion that came out of it. But, you know, I was on the class war side of things. I was on the side of the only color that matters is green. We need economic equality. Then all of the other stuff would come. I'm curious, what's your assessment of 10 years after?
Well, so when I started kind of hanging around, I was a lefty journalist hanging around Occupy. I decided to write a piece for The Nation, actually, 10 years ago. Almost exactly 10 years ago, about just talking to women who are already very involved. That was about a month or less into Occupy at Zuccotti Park, because the immediate image in the media of Occupy was this sort of classic, like manarchist is what people say, class above all kind of white male image of who was down there. But in fact, that wasn't the case, because as you said, many, many people of all stripes and from all backgrounds were aware of how bad economic equality had gotten and were aware of the raw deal that people got, particularly after, you know, the bank bailouts after the financial crisis. And the chant you could hear all the time on all the marches at Zuccotti was, banks got bailed out, we got sold out, over and over again. And, you know, it had a huge effect on a lot of people, including me, and sort of waking us up to just how bad things had gotten. But what the people I spoke to, the women I spoke to 10 years ago, also kind of found was that they were facing a lot of ignorance about how that oppression, how that class oppression interacted or intersected, as we say now all the time, with racism, with sexism, with homophobia. And they had to do a lot of teaching, a lot of education. Like, we can't just say things like, we're all one race, we're the human race, and, you know, race doesn't matter. And there was a lot of discussion about how to interact with the cops, because the police were, you know, down there. There was a lot of horrible police brutality against protesters, but it was much more fraught for people of color who had trauma in that arena. in their past. And then similarly, there was sexual harassment, there was sexual assault in the park. So what a lot of feminists and, you know, anti-racist activists were finding is that even though they had kind of agreed with the goals of Occupy, they had to do a lot of extra work with their comrades. And that was frustrating, but they were also very excited about it. So what I decided to do this summer was just go back and talk to some of those people and see, you know, what their assessment was 10 years later of that, and what's changed. And I think what a lot of them have felt is that they don't have to do, that some things haven't changed, but they don't have to do some of that educating, that the 10 years since Occupy have seen such a cultural shift in how we talk about class because of Occupy, how we talk about race because of Black Lives Matter, how we talk about sexual harassment because of Me Too, how we talk about gender and transphobia. So you know, Occupy in some ways was the beginning for a lot of people who showed up there of all these conversations that we now kind of take for granted.
Well, I would also argue that it was that spark that got people back into the streets. The idea that working people, that that we have power as long as we figure out how to deal with the divisions. Because one of the things the wealth class has masterfully been able to do is pit us against each other on those lines, be it race, be it gender, whatever. They've always been able to divide us. And it's one of those things that I've been talking about for years, that the only way we move forward as a working class is if we can heal some of those. You may not always agree, but find common ground where you can agree and move forward in those directions. And I think Occupy did. I think it did what it was supposed to. It was the seed.
Yeah, I think so too. And so did a lot of the people I spoke to. I mean, because they were so involved in the movement, a lot of the people I interviewed for the piece, you know, had a lot of critiques and nitpicks about what went wrong and what could have been done better. But they, at the end of the day, I think most of them felt that we're having these conversations and we have these figures like Bernie and AOC. And it's not that these figures emerged because of Wall Street, but they're able to say more radical things and propose more radical solutions, in part because of the climate that Occupy created that allowed us to talk about class oppression and economic inequality in such stark terms. And AOC is like the sort of classic like post-Occupy figure, because she is so seamless in the way she goes back and forth from her socialism with her discussion of her identity as a woman and as a woman of color. And she's just so fluent and comfortable in all those different languages in a way that people were still trying to hash out during Occupy. So she's like the perfect post-Occupy generation figure in some ways, that, you know, that people at Occupy were striving to educate each other, to be able to talk in all those different languages. But one thing that that was different about Occupy also is there was this constant public presence, right? It wasn't just marches. It was people were living together and eating together and arguing with each other and talking with each other for months straight and suffering together. And I think that a lot of people who were there, even for a few days, who were at the different encampments around the country, went home or went back to their communities and started doing really serious activism or got into politics. I talked to one person who ran for city council and won. She's one of our newest city council women. So it's very, it sparked a million seeds. It planted a million seeds.
Yeah, really, and I would argue also it gave people, for the first time probably in a lot of people's lives, the opportunity to talk to people that they didn't you know, associate with generally, that weren't living in their neighborhoods. It was a community kind of thing. Now, it had its problems, and I agree there were some problems, but not the way the media blew it out of proportion, that they were just, you know, the message I got, just a bunch of dirty hippies with no ideas. And the reality is they had a lot of very solid policy ideas. The problem is the fringe, the people who were there just to hear themselves speak, they got a lot of the most attention, to where the real issues somehow got lost in some tragic things that also happened.
Absolutely. I mean, there were sort of all those difficult currents that happened towards the end, but you can't forget how amazing and what some of the people I spoke to were saying is how electrifying it was at the beginning, even with the frustrations, even with having to argue with people. there was so much idealism and so much optimism and so many sparks flying. And there was this public square aspect where you're right, people were speaking to people they had nothing in common with in theory, except for politics, and from all walks of life, and joining together and learning how to do that kind of activism. And actually, it was, I mean, I think that there were so many, there were a lot of people down at Occupy who had worked on the Obama campaign and were disillusioned by what electoral politics could actually achieve, or who had, you know, been involved in more traditional politics and felt frustrated. And that has certainly continued on the left, and, you know, with people forming these movements, whether it's BLM or Me Too or the pipeline defense. I mean, there have been these flashpoints in the last decade where the entire left kind of rallied to a cause.
No, and it's to my view, it's because the Democrats, you know, walked away from the working class, you know, decades ago. And we've got too many centrist DLC type Democrats,
yep,
who have not done the things that, you know, Obama to me was a great disappointment. I have a lot of my friends who go, no, he's the greatest president ever. To me, it was a great disappointment. There was so much hope that hope and change was coming, and it didn't just happen. There were a lot of half measures and a lot of things that didn't get done. And like you said, we bailed the banks out, we bailed out the wealthy, but we were still kicking people out of their homes. And yeah, out of Occupy came a lot of things. Out of that entire movement came a lot of things. The Home Defenders League, where people were basically, yep, just crowding someone's home so the sheriff can't throw all their stuff out in the streets. Yeah. For me, that's the kind of activism that put us in the position we're in now.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I think, yeah, we can't downplay the importance of the moment where the Obama administration chose to bail out the banks, even while the eviction crisis was happening, and that a lot of people had put their faith in that election. And when it didn't work out, you know, when policy-wise, exactly as they hoped, that was the spark for Occupy and also for the first wave of Black Lives Matter protests. Those movements were born in the Obama administration, which is always, you know, very interesting to me to remember, because Trump has caused kind of some amnesia because it was so traumatic.
The thing is there's a difference here for me. I'm angry at Obama than I was at Trump. I expected what we got out of Trump. I wanted better from Democrats. I wanted better from Obama, because he said, look, you can trust me. We're not going to get these bad trade deals, and we got more bad trade deals. We're gonna help people. We're gonna give people opportunity, hope, and change. It just didn't happen, and for a bunch of reasons. And again, it's the Democratic Party doing their circular firing squad that you're seeing now. That was a big part of it. Obviously, we can rehash Joe Lieberman and all the nonsense that went on around that and the healthcare bill. But it's just Democrats aren't delivering the same way that Republicans do, and that's why I think we need these movements to push people in the direction.
It has changed the discourse so much. I mean, the way Biden talks, you know, obviously there's many imperfections and disappointments there too, but that is a climate that's created in part because of Warren and Sanders running for president and having enormous popularity. And that is in part because of the climate that Occupy and these other movements have created. So you can't understate how important.
Right.
I understand.
You know, Occupy was Athenian democracy, an attempt at Athenian democracy in public square. And democracy is ugly. Democracy is loud. Yeah. It's noisy. And it's you know, to be honest, it doesn't get much done in the moment. But what we've seen, I think, over the last decade is some of the issues that came out of there. We've been making some progress on it. And I think that's the important part, at least for me as someone who showed up to a bunch of those meetings. That's the important part, that something did long-term come out of it. As someone who's a labor historian, I read labor history. You go back to the 20s and the 30s of the organizing that happened there. They actually set the groundwork for the passage of the Wagner Act and the explosion of organizing in the 40s. So it takes time for these movements to actually mature and to grow and have leaders and get where we are today, I think.
And that is a lesson that a lot of the people I spoke to, you know, the majority of the people I spoke to were in their 20s when Occupy happened, or now in their 30s. And what they, much like me, and what they said was that, you know, that realization that progress is slow and progress takes different turns, and that you have to take moments out to like care for your comrades and for yourself, was something that they kind of had to learn the hard way during Occupy, because it was so intense and it was 24/7. They were, you know, we were up at 3 a.m. trying to defend the park when the cops came to evict people. And sort of in the time since then, there's been more of a realization that you can keep pushing slowly and steadily, and there will be these flashpoints like Occupy, but in between, you can still make progress in a sort of slow and steady way.
Yeah. So the question then becomes, you know, we look at this 10th anniversary, what does 10 more years get us? Where do you see us going from this point? Because as you've said, in the last 10 years, there has been a major cultural shift, and you can, the roots are right back to the Occupy movement. Where do you see this going in 10 more years? Do you see a potential backlash? Do you see more growth? How do you see the future playing out?
I think what I've been thinking about a lot since Occupy is that you can never predict what the flashpoint is going to be that brings people out into the streets, right? I mean, no one could have predicted that George Floyd. You could have predicted that something was going to happen around Black Lives Matter, but that would happen during COVID that summer. You know, that summer. That particular moment, you couldn't predict it. I wouldn't have necessarily predicted that Occupy would happen when it did. Something tends to happen to sort of excite the popular imagination and outrage, and you know, and or even the Harvey Weinstein story. Like, what happened after that? I wouldn't, you know. So I think that it's a mystery what the next flashpoint is going to be. And the hope is that the activists who have been in all these different movements in the last decade, and the younger people coming through who have benefited from their struggles, what will they do with that moment, and how will they take advantage of it to push radical change? It's really exciting to think about because there's so much wisdom. I mean, I tend to interview activists. That's like what I love to do as a journalist. And, you know, there's been a lot of wisdom gained over this 10 years of different movements. because a lot of people that I spoke to have been involved in various, you know, some of them were doing pipeline defense, were at Occupy, were involved in Black Lives Matter. So the question, or then got involved in like the Bernie campaign or whatever. So there's, what are they going to do with their experience and their knowledge when the next moment comes? It's a really interesting and kind of exciting question.
Yeah, I think we're in one of those moments right now, especially in the work world. As you're seeing, especially people in the low wage work jobs, mm-hmm. saying, you know what, we're not having this. And I think we're living through a moment of major transition.
I absolutely agree. And I would even draw a connection between the low wage workers refusing to work in these horrendous conditions, like in, you know, the food industry, and things like, you know, tennis players, famous tennis players and gymnasts saying, I'm not going to be your performing. You know, I'm not going to be just performing for an audience if my mental health isn't good. I think there's like there's a moment of mass refusal that's sort of quietly happening in all walks of life where people say, I want my life to be more than
I want to be better. I'm right there with
beyond more than just working. And I want it to be better. I want to have a decent life. Right. So, that's really interesting to me to see kind of where that goes.
Yeah, me too. The piece, Sexism and Racism on the Left, What Has and Hasn't Changed Since Occupy Wall Street, written by Sarah Seltzer. We'll make sure we get links out on social media how you can take a look at that. Sarah, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Thank you
so much for having me.
Good stuff. I appreciate it.
Take care.
I'd love to hear your thoughts as well. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. For working people, have a good time.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1830. That was the day that the Reverend Richard Allen brought black leaders together at his Mother Bethel AME Church in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. They met to discuss the rising white violence and discrimination toward black free residents in northern cities. 40 people answered Allen's call, representing 7 states. The delegates included many of the leading black ministers and abolitionists of the day. Those who attended risked personal harm as white mobs threatened the delegates. Due to the danger, the group met in secret starting on September 15th. Then, on this day, they began open sessions. For 5 days, the delegates considered multiple responses to the conditions Black Northerners faced. They founded the American Society for Free Persons of Color for improving their conditions in the United States, for purchasing lands, and for establishment of a settlement in the province of Canada. The organization emphasized pushing for legal protections for Black residents in the United States. They focused on education as a means of uplifting and improving the lives of Black citizens. But delegates also supported the idea of an outlet to Canada for those Black families who wanted to leave for their safety. The National Convention reconvened several times over the next 3 decades. Multiple meetings were held at the state and local levels. These meetings gave Black leaders a chance to devise coordinated strategies to stand up against the increasing violence and restrictive laws of the North, and to call for an end of slavery in the South. One outcome of these meetings was the founding of labor schools to train Black students in the skilled trades as a means to gain economic independence. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com. Tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. We are radio of, for, and by we the working people. Check out our program 8 to 9 a.m. Tuesday through Saturday right here on Progressive Voices.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as we've been talking about the last several weeks, we know that our 1% don't pay their fair share. We've known that for a while. But some of the numbers that we're seeing coming out, like our good friends over at Americans for Tax Fairness have been doing some fantastic work at pointing out just how much our wealth class is pocketing and not putting into our coffers. In fact, the estimate of over $600 billion a year in unpaid taxes kind of makes your head spin when you're talking about over 10 years, they're saying almost $7 trillion goes uncollected. And yet the $3.5 trillion we're talking about investing in our human infrastructure is a bridge too far. Just can't do it. Way too big, according to Joe Manchin and Kelly Simina. I'm saying, you know what? It should be double that. We make people pay what they're supposed to pay, and we invest and make this the best country possible. And here to share some thoughts on how we can do that, how we can get the investment that we need, and the revenue to do it. I've asked Seth Hanlon to come talk with us. Seth is a senior fellow for economics at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, their website. Seth, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So we can't afford it, Seth. Yeah. Too much money. We're broke. The debt, the deficit, all that. It's just not there, man. Love to do it. Love to invest. Can't do it.
I mean, like you said, I mean, if only we collected just the taxes that people owe already, right? And we didn't even have to raise taxes. But if we just collect the taxes we owe already, that would collect about $7 trillion over the next decade. So that's going to pay for the entire Build Back Better agenda twice over. Now it's difficult to do that, right? It's not not easy to make, you know, crack down on every example of tax evasion, people getting away with cheating. But the Biden administration has a pretty bold initiative to put a big dent in what's called the tax gap. So that the tax gap is the difference between what people owe and what actually gets paid. And it's a really common sense proposal. And they estimate it's going to raise about $700 billion over the next 10 years, you know, which is fairly modest in ambition. I mean, that's about 1/10 of the tax gap. But it pays for a big chunk of the Build Back Better agenda.
Yeah. But here, I'm looking at what ProPublica pointed out. We'll just look at Jeff Bezos, the richest man in the world, basically. They say his wealth grew by $99 billion from 2014 to 2018, and he paid $978 million, or a true tax rate of 1% Look, you know, I don't know anybody who pays that kind of a low tax rate. They also say in 2007 and 11, he paid zero. This is the richest man in the world not paying anything. And we can't afford to build roads. We can't afford to feed hungry children. We can't afford to address the homelessness issue with veterans. We can't afford to pave the damn road out in front of my house. But we can afford to let this guy get off without paying anything.
I know. And the crazy thing with someone like with Bezos and that situation that ProPublica exposed, that stuff is legal. You know, I mean, the scandal is what's legal there. And that has to do with the failures of our capital gains system. And so we really need to reform those if we're going to get at the problem of billionaires like Jeff Bezos not paying any taxes.
Yeah, I mean, you know, again, and I'm not saying anything against Bezos. Like you said, he's following the rules that he and his ilk funded to rig for he and his ilk. And I get this. And this is where the rest of us have got to stop having this Pavlovian kind of response to every time we hear anyone talking about we need to raise taxes, that we start foaming at the mouth. We say, who are we going to raise taxes on? Well, we're going to raise taxes on the people who have all the money and have not been paying taxes for the last 40 years. Maybe that's a good place to start.
I think so. I mean, yeah, if you look at the wealth growth of the top 1%, one statistic that I came across is really, really puts things in perspective. Over the last 10 years, the top 1%, the wealth of the top 1% has grown by $23 trillion, $23 trillion, just accruing to the top 1% since 2011. And of course, President Biden wants to spend or invest $3.5 trillion over the next 10 years. I mean, so just to put these numbers, $3.5 trillion sounds like a big number, but the $23 trillion really puts it in perspective.
Yeah. Now, how do we get to this point? You guys have a piece out now on bank tax reporting being critical to Biden's Build Back Better plan. What exactly is bank tax reporting? Who does it affect? What is it? And how is it going to help?
Got it. Okay. So this is part of the pay-fors of the Build Back Better bill, right? So there's $3.5 trillion of investments. And like I said, about $700 billion of it is from a initiative by the Biden administration and the Treasury Department and IRS to make sure that people who owe taxes are paying the taxes they owe. So we're losing about $163 billion per year just from the top 1% in unpaid taxes. So there's two components of this tax enforcement agenda that President Biden's proposed. Number one is to rebuild the IRS, which has been just decimated by budget cuts over the last 10 years to the point where they have no ability to go after high income Americans and the largest corporations. They're just completely outgunned. And then the second component of it, equally important, is this bank tax reporting proposal. And so what that does is it gives the IRS a sort of better window into flows of money in bank accounts. So right now, if you're a regular person, regular worker, earning wages, the IRS knows exactly how much you make because they get a W-2 form from your employer every year. So there's no way for you to cheat. I mean, even if you wanted to cheat, you Right. can't do it. The IRS already knows how much you're earning. But owners of businesses, particularly pass-through businesses like partnerships and S corporations, that's where a really outsized share of the tax gap comes from, and where a lot of the cheating is. And the reason for that is there's nobody, unlike the W-2 with your employer reporting your income, there's no third-party information reporting. So nobody is sort of verifying and the IRS has no visibility into people's or partnerships' income streams. So what the bank tax reporting proposal does is pretty simple. It basically just says for bank accounts, right now you would get if you have a $10 of interest, you would get a 1099 INT from your bank,
right?
And the IRS gets that same form. So right now this says that for bank accounts above a certain size, just the gross inflows, so the total amount of money that has flowed in for the past year and the total amount of money that has flowed out, gets reported on a form similar to the 1099 INT. So it's basically the sort of most basic top line information about money flowing through bank accounts.
Got it. So what my conservative friends heard from what you just said is you're supporting bringing the IRS back to terrorize us and shake us down. And you want the IRS and the government to snoop in our bank accounts. That's what my conservative friends heard.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a lot of mischaracterizations of this proposal out there. And I think a lot of it comes from the lobbyists for banks, frankly, that are they're stirring up some of these fears. I mean, so I think we need to be clear on what this proposal is and is not. The IRS is not going to be able to see individual transactions in accounts. I mean, they're not going to be able to see what you're spending money on, who you're getting money from. That's not even it. It's just the total amount of flows in and out of bank accounts. And the reason that's important is that it's going to give the IRS the ability to choose where to look more carefully. And so from the standpoint of an honest, ordinary taxpayer, they're going to be much, much less likely to be audited under this proposal, because the IRS is going to be able to find, you know, these business entities or partnerships or layers of partnerships that have all kinds of money flowing through that doesn't come close to matching what's reported on tax returns. So basically, it makes the IRS a lot sort of smarter and more efficient about how to choose who to audit, because they have an inkling, a clue as to where the real money is.
Right.
I think it's critical from the standpoint of you know, average people. First of all, the IRS already knows your income before you even file your return. But this proposal is going to make it much less likely for you to be audited, and not to mention give you a fair shake, because you're paying your taxes and, you know, the rich guy down the street or on the other side of town might not be.
Yeah, see, we need people to pay their taxes. I pay mine. I, like you said, every dime is accounted for when you work for a living. And most working people are that way as well. But we've been trained for a very long time to, anytime you hear the IRS, to get all angry, because nobody likes to pay taxes. I know I don't, but I know it's the price of admission. That's how we pave our roads. That's how we do all the things that we need to get done. And that's what we need to invest in the future. My problem is still the scale of cheating that's going on at the top. And it's not even really cheating. It's the fact that they've rigged the rules of the game to where they don't even have to cheat. They just hire enough tax avoidance lawyers and they can avoid paying anything, which is insane to me when the richest guy in the country is paying the same tax rate as someone living below the poverty line. I got a problem with that.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, it's both rigged rules and rules that are being broken. I mean, I think it's both. I mean, I think the Bezos situation with paying an ultra low tax rate, I mean, that has to do with the fact that we don't tax capital gains until they're sold. And then so you can go your whole life. And then the so-called stepped up basis loophole lets billionaires go their entire lives and pass assets on heirs without ever paying capital gains taxes on those gains. So that's a, you know, situation where the scandal is what's legal.
Right.
But then there's just a whole amount of just illegal criminal activity. With, like I said, $163 billion of it per year coming from the top 1%.
Now, as you said, they're going to be looking at these bank accounts. And, you know, one of the things that I saw in the piece was, you know, landlords who, you know, I guess a good portion of the wealth that the taxes that aren't being paid are basically these landlords who aren't paying tax on their properties. How would you catch these folks in what you're proposing here?
I mean, so if you write a check to your landlord and they're cashing that check and putting the money in their bank account and then not reporting, I mean, so, you know, let's say a landlord gets, several hundred thousand dollars of rent checks a year, and then they report, you know, $50,000 of gross revenue for the year. I mean, the IRS is going to, that's going to send up a flag with the IRS. Now, the thing is, there could be innocent or, you know, innocent explanations. These group bank flows are not going to directly equate to taxable income. But it's definitely going to, there are just so many situations you could think of where, you know, let's say a partnership owns a bank account, and there's millions of dollars flowing through the partnership. But then the partnership files no tax returns, and the IRS doesn't even know who owns the partnership. So that's, you know, that's a red flag. The IRS will want to look closer.
Why do we already have this? I mean, because I'll be honest with you. I'm a small business owner myself. I deposit a check in my account. There's no question that it's in the bookkeeping. So when my accountant goes to do my taxes at the end of the year, everything matches up, because the last thing I want is to be audited ever. And I'm of the mindset, I hope most businesses think the same way I do. You thought that it was going in. There was a record of it. There's a paper trail. You don't violate that. From what I'm getting from you is, That's not quite right.
I mean, I think the more you sort of read about the criminal cases that they bring and hear some of the stories. I mean, there's a lot of businesses that have a double set of books. I mean, I'll give one example. There's a case in New York about it. The Trump Organization, just completely kept two sets of books, one for tax purposes and one for reality purposes, right? You know, and they just kept certain payments that were compensation for employees just totally off the books. So I think there's a lot of, you know, the IRS has been so decimated. The audit rates for millionaires and for large partnerships have plummeted by so much that I think there really is a ton of just brazen tax evasion going on.
They don't fear a cop on the beat at all. So it's even worse than we probably even know. But you brought up the former guy, which has sent, again, my conservative listeners into a tizzy, because now can this be said that this is all about Trump and his tax returns? That this is what this is really about, Seth. It's not about actually investing money. It's about punishing the former guy.
No, I mean, it's not even about punishing anybody. It's about collecting the taxes that are owed under current law. I mean, it's sort of just that simple.
Yeah. Last line of questioning I got for you, because in this political moment that we're in, I'm sure you know it as well as anyone. It seems like nothing can get passed because nothing can seem to get agreed upon. I guess I should ask, what does Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema think of this? Because they seem to be the most powerful people in the country right now. Where's their mindset on this?
It's a good question. I mean, I think right now we have to get this through the bank reporting proposal through the House. Right now, the IRS, the funding for rebuilding and modernizing the IRS is in there in the House bill. But the bank reporting proposal is not in the bill yet. The chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, Richie Neal, said he's working with the administration on essentially a compromise to exempt smaller accounts. And they have to figure out exactly what the exemption level is and all that. But they're still working on it. So it's not in the House bill yet. So this is why, you know, this is why we wrote the report last week, to really put pressure on Congress. And then I haven't heard any concerns from Manchin and Sinema on this one. And I think that, you know, they might be, I think they're focused mostly on the size of the investment.
The spending,
I
mean, size, right.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of misguided to focus on the top line price tag of the overall bill and not the importance of the individual contents, the specific investments.
Yeah. Especially if you're someone like Joe Manchin, who comes from one of the poorest states in the country, that this kind of investment could really boost.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, in so many different ways, the child tax credit and just so many investments in infrastructure and the care economy, in childcare and education and modernizing schools. I mean, just so many ways. And, I think this whole initiative of the Biden administration and focusing on the tax gap just sort of underscores there is so much money out there that it is just simply taxes that are owed but not paid. Yep. And if we go after it, I mean, we get, you know, so many hundreds of billions of revenue. It just is a further illustration that there's sort of just no excuse for Congress to skimp on the long overdue investments.
I agree. It seems to me like the low-hanging fruit, because we didn't even get to talk about raising the rates on the wealthy or on corporations. This is just getting them to pay what the rest of us pay. I hope folks will take a look at the piece. Bank tax reporting is a critical component of Biden's Build Back Better agenda. We'll get links out on social media how you can take a look at that. Seth, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Great talk with you.
Sure. Yeah, always fun.
Good stuff. Make sure you check out the peaceamericanprogress.org, the website. We'll get links out on how you can check that out. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.